All right, let us begin. Today is Psalm 82. Rise up, O God, judge the earth, for all the nations belong to you. Sort of says it all, doesn't it? Let us begin with our psalm. God stands in the divine assembly among the divine beings. He pronounces judgment. How long will you judge perversely, showing favor to the wicked? Judge the wretched and the orphan, vindicate the lowly and the poor, rescue the wretched and the needy, save them from the hand of the wicked. They neither know nor understand, they go about in darkness, all the foundations of the earth totter. I had taken you for divine beings, Son of the Most High, all of you, but you shall die as men do, fall like any prince. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for all the nations are your possession. This is an interesting psalm. It's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, according to the rabbinic tradition, this psalm was sung by the Levitical choir in the temple on Tuesdays. Why? We don't know. How we know that they did that? We don't know. But this is what we find in the rabbinical tradition. What we find in Psalm 82 is a vision. This is a vision of a celestial scene, similar to the one that we see in Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah sees God enthroned and seated on a throne surrounded by his angels, by a divine assembly. Psalm 82 clearly is a courtroom scene of some sort, and some of its language is drawn from the world of the mythology of the ancient Near East, so it would be recognizable on those grounds. And we've already talked about how the ancient Israelites used the language of their world and give it a particular meaning that is a polemic against the polytheistic mythologies of their neighbors, and use it to describe the belief in the one God, Yahweh, the personal God of Israel. And verse 1 sets the tone for the whole rest of the psalm. God stands in the divine assembly among the divine beings. He pronounces judgment. What's fascinating is that the exact same word for God and divine assembly is used, Elohim. So Elohim stands in the divine assembly among the Elohim, and it's among the Elohim that he pronounces judgment. So we need to do a little philology here, which is the fancy way of talking about what words mean and how they change over time. The first thing that jumps out at us from this passage is that the author of the psalm uses the exact same word for God as for divine beings. And the word Elohim is one of the names of the God of Israel in the Hebrew Bible. And as we've discussed in past week, Elohim is used in the Bible as a comprehensive term for supernatural beings as well. Okay, so when it can be applied to angels, it can be applied to the sons of God in Genesis chapter 6, who are having relations with human women, you know, where it talks about that. I mean, it's going to be used in those kinds of contexts. And so there is this other supernatural realm that's recognized in the Hebrew Bible. It's not laid out for us in great detail, which is frustrating. But it's really good if you have an imagination, because then you can write novels, you can make a ministry out of it, you can kind of make up all kinds of stuff and have a lot of fun with it. But the key thing here for our purposes is that Psalm 82 begins with Elohim and not Yahweh. And scholars argue, or they divide this book of Psalms up into a lot of divisions, but one of the divisions is what they refer to as the Elohistic Psalter and the Yahwistic Psalter. And what they mean by that is that you have a group of psalms in which the name for God is Elohim, and it's used much more frequently than the personal name for God, which is Yahweh. And in your handout, I gave you the numbers there, that the section of the book of Psalms that is called the Elohistic Psalter is Psalms 42 to 83. And they seem to be a group of psalms that are probably from the north, that probably were employed in the northern parts of of Israel, because the literature that comes, the parts of the Bible that derive from the northern territories, from the region that is going to be Israel, not Judah, tend to use Elohim more than Yahweh, which you find in the Judah texts. And we don't need to go into how that stuff works out, but you just need to know that, you know, the words are used, the names are used more frequently in the northern material than in the southern material. Here, this group of psalms that are called the Eloistic Psalter by scholars are called that because the personal name Yahweh isn't used as frequently, and Yahweh occurs only 45 times in these 40-some psalms. Okay, the personal name for the God of Israel that Moses, when he asked God at the burning bush, "Who shall I say sent me?" He says, "Tell them that Yahweh sent you. This is my name, and it shall be my name forever." Elohim, however, occurs 210 times. Okay, and so this is the name that is used primarily in the northern regions. In the rest of the book of Psalms, Elohim only occurs 94 times, and the personal name for God 584 times. So you can see that there is a difference in emphasis here. Okay, I mean, it's not just, you know, nerdy academics playing with numbers. I mean, the numbers are real, and they're pretty impressive that there is a difference in emphasis. So the question is, why? Well, this is not a question. Let me rephrase it. Whatever the original significance of using Elohim in this psalm, okay, is it a northern psalm that is going to be incorporated into the Bible, which is put together in the time period when there is no north anymore, right? Because it's going to take its final form when there is no northern kingdom. Is there some reason for that? That we can't answer. What we can say with certainty is that the first word of the psalm is referring to Yahweh. It is referring to the personal God of Israel. Okay, but he is the term that is being used here is not Yahweh's name. Another thing that's interesting about this psalm is that we have the psalmist seeing God standing amidst a celestial assembly. And we have plenty of other examples in the Hebrew Bible of a divine assembly. I mean, God says, "Let us make man in our own image." Okay, one Christian interpretation of that is that, see, this is the Trinity. My opinion, that's a bit of a stretch. In the context of the Hebrew Bible, we're talking about, you know, this is an example of the divine assembly that shows up repeatedly throughout the Hebrew Bible. That's not to say that it's not the Trinity, but I don't think it certainly wasn't read that way until after the time of Jesus. The concept of a divine assembly shows up throughout the neighboring literature, and so one might suspect that this is an idea. The particular phrasing of divine assembly in this psalm is unique to this psalm. The concept of an assembly of God and other supernatural beings is not unique to the Hebrew Bible. So it conceivably that this phrase dot L, or the assembly of God, is something that existed in the pre-Canaanite period, and that the Israelites are giving it a new meaning. Whatever the case may be about that, it is very clear that the idea of a celestial court of gods and their pantheon is common throughout Mesopotamian literature, Syrian literature, Egyptian literature, and whatever. In biblical monotheism, this concept of a divine assembly has been transformed into the concept of not a whole host of gods, but an assembly in which Yahweh is in charge, and there is no doubt about that, but that he does have his underlings, whether they're angels or supernatural beings in some way, shape, or form. And these guys are supernatural beings, but they are not. They are explicitly not of equal or even close to equal standing with Yahweh. Okay, so this is a very, very important point that we need to sort out. The language of a divine assembly, the language or the concept of supernatural beings who are above this order, this world that we live in, and that are subservient to God, this is not something that is foreign to the Hebrew Bible. We find it in many places. And I'm just going to give you a couple of examples here. When the prophet Micaiah was summoned before King Jehoshaphat of Judah, we are told in the first book of Kings that he saw, quote, the Lord seated upon his throne with all the host of heaven standing in attendance to the right and to the left of him. So we have these plenty of examples of these visions that you have God, Yahweh, seated on his throne, and there is the host of heaven. We don't know who that host is. That's the frustrating thing. We would like to know, you know, what do they look like? Do they wear white robes? Do they have wings? Do they have these things? Do they look like that? And whatever. In the imagination of the ancient Israelites, they probably did not look like what we think of as angels. They probably were not, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, fair-skinned people in white robes with wings. They probably looked like what you see out in front of the pyramids at Giza, the Sphinxes there. Okay, they probably were half animal, half human beasts with wings, like a sphinx. Those tend to be when you think of cherubim and seraphim and these kinds of things, the imagery of angels and supernatural beings in the Western artistic tradition is significantly different than how these characters are depicted in the ancient Near Eastern world. I don't know, since they're supernatural, they could look like both, depending on how they want to be perceived, right? I mean, they can do what they want. They're certainly have more leeway than we do. The book of Job includes two accounts when the divine beings presented themselves to the Lord. Later in the book of Job, one of Job's friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, which means a guy from Yemen. Whenever you see Teman in the Bible, it means more or less modern-day Yemen. He asked Job, have you listened on the counsel of God? Jeremiah refers to standing in the counsel of the Lord. Psalm 89 speaks of the counsel of holy beings. Okay, so I gave you all of those references. You can go look them up later. But we have plenty of examples of a divine counsel. Pardon? Pardon?
There's a hymn called Standing
in the Counsel of God? Okay. I don't know that one. I should know that one. Cause... Yeah, I would love you to sing it.
Well, I don't know if I'm in voice, but it's standing in the room of God. Something like that.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. All right. I know it as standing on the promises of God. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, the leaning on the everlasting arms, you know that hymn? I had a teacher once, and he says, no, don't be leaning on the everlasting oars here. I want you guys to get to work. You know, so, I mean, he would sort of modify the hymn for motivational purposes. Okay. All right. Now, clearly, Psalm 82 is envisioning these heavenly beings, these Elohim, as being the members of this divine assembly. And that the divine assembly is clearly presided over by God himself. Now, I'll speculate, and that's all I'll do is because I don't know. I'll speculate about who these supernatural beings might be in a few minutes. But first we need to clarify why it is that God is standing in this council when in just about every other case that we find a judge or God acting as a judge in the Hebrew Bible, he's sitting. Okay, judges sit in judgment. In this psalm, God is standing. And I think that there is a reason for God standing in this psalm. And we'll get to that in a minute. But just to give you an example, Jethro, who was Moses' father-in-law, he's the Midianite priest, he observed Moses. And what is Moses doing? He's acting as a judge, and he was seated. Okay, and we see this in Exodus chapter 18. So when Jethro sees Moses acting as a judge, Moses is seated. Deborah, who is a prophet and a judge, she used to sit under a palm tree and administer justice. Samuel did the same thing. Isaiah refers to somebody who sits in judgment. Joel declares that in the future, at some point, God will sit in judgment on all the nations. Psalm 9 describes God as enthroned as a righteous judge. Well, if you're enthroned, you're not standing on the chair, right? You're sitting in the throne. We're also told in chapter 9 that God has set up his throne for judgment. Psalm 122 declares that in Jerusalem, the thrones of judgment stood, thrones of the house of David. Okay, so it's on these thrones that judgment is administered. Proverbs also speaks of the king seated on the throne of judgment, and there are loads and loads of other examples that we could look up. Which brings us back to the original question. If judges are supposed to be sitting, or if they're, I don't know if they're supposed to be, let's say they are depicted as sitting, why does Psalm 82 portray God as standing? And the probable answer for this, this is an answer that makes the most sense to me. There could be other answers, but this is one that seems to make most sense to me, is that the scene that's described in Psalm 82 is a description of a scene after the proceedings have already occurred. And after the legal proceedings have concluded, now God is going to stand up and he's going to give his pronouncement. This seems to be a plausible answer to this. Basically, all that remains to be done in this vision that the psalmist is describing is the sentence needs to be pronounced. Now, if this interpretation is correct, and for the purposes of today, it's going to be correct. Okay, for our purposes today, that is the interpretation that we're going to follow. The proceedings are finished, and God stands, or he rises to pass judgment. And he stands or he rises to pass judgment because his word inherently carries with it absolute certainty of fulfillment. And this concept of God arising or God standing always has a sense of imminence or immediacy to it when it is used in the Hebrew Bible. Words that have to do with standing up or to rise indicate imminent action. So, I think that because of that, this is why in this psalm, God is so often called upon, in other psalms, God is called upon to arise. That is, he's called upon to execute judgment, to get after it, to get busy, to do it now. Okay, stand up and do it. And this is what is happening here in our verse. In Psalm 12, God declares, because of the groans of the plundered, poor, and needy, I will now act. And literally the word that's there in Hebrew, it's translated that I will now act. It is, I will arise. Okay? So the idea that by the act of standing connotates immediate action. I will now act, says the Lord, or I will arise, says the Lord. I will give help, he affirms to him. In Psalm 76, we have a similar situation. In heaven you pronounce sentence. The earth was numbed with fright as God arose to execute judgment, to deliver all the lowly of the earth. So God he's acting now. Okay, it's time to act, and he's going to do that. So the question, if God is standing to execute judgment, okay, there's more than just, you know, he's standing in the assembly. Why is he standing in the assembly? Because he's getting ready to execute judgment. If he is standing to execute judgment, if our presupposition is correct, then it would be nice to know why judgment is required. What has happened that needs to be judged? And this is made abundantly clear in verses 2, 3, and 4. How long will you judge perversely, showing favor to the wicked? Judge the wretched and the orphan, vindicate the lowly and the poor, rescue the wretched and the needy, save them from the hand of the wicked. Justice has been perverted, clearly. Okay? The question is, who are the perverters of justice? And we'll get to that in a minute. So God is intervening and assembles his divine assembly because the judicial system is corrupt because social morality is in a state of decay. Things have gotten so bad that God must stand. God must arise. God must administer his judgment. And anybody who's familiar with the Hebrew Bible, and I know that you all are, you know that these are recurring themes in the prophets of the 8th century. And the corruption is a result of a confluence of political, economic, and social factors in the 8th century, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But before we can get to how things have gotten so bad in the time period of Isaiah and the prophets who are that we've repeatedly referred to this semester, we need to discuss the situation in times past. One of the things that you find in the prophets, like Isaiah most explicitly, and some of the other ones, Micah as well, in the 8th century, they hearken back to a time when things were better. And when were things better? Things were better when we didn't have cities. Things were better when we were more of a village society. Things were better when things were more agricultural. Now, this is not unique to the biblical prophets, okay? I think this is the human condition that things were always better in the olden days. And there's a wonderful book, I forget the author of it, but the title is something like The Good Old Days Were Not So Good. Okay, and he's a historian of the America, and he talks about how, you know, what life is really like in the 19th century. You know, you die rather quickly. There is no vaccinations. There are no vaccinations, so you know, child mortality is huge. Sanitation is horrible. Life is just plain hard. So it's not, you know, the good old days are not always so good. Anyway, but here, for our purposes, the conquest of Canaan in the mid-1200s, okay, B.C., in the 13th century B.C., transformed the life of the ancient Israelites from being pastoral nomads, which is how they are described in the book of Genesis with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph. Then they're enslaved in Egypt. Then they wander for 40 years in the desert, okay, in the regions of Sinai and northern Saudi Arabia, southern Jordan of today, and you're living in tents. Then they cross in, and we begin the conquest of Canaan. During the period of the judges, the Israelites became settled farmers, and primarily in the highland areas of what is now known as the West Bank. Okay, the highland areas on the western bank of the Jordan River. And it's in these hills that the Israelites found protection, because hills are their own natural defenses. They found protection that did not exist in the more fertile plains. The plain areas, if you go to the Jezreel Valley, if you go down to the coast along the west, the land is much more fertile, much more productive, but it's much more susceptible to invasion and attack. And that it's the road by which the armies of Egypt and the armies of Assyria are marching up and down all the time. Well, not every day of the week, but I mean, for centuries they are periodically marching through those areas. So the mountains and the hills of the West Bank or Samaria provide protection. Because one of the things that the Israelites don't have, they don't have walled cities. Okay, they haven't made it to that point yet. Okay, and if you don't have a walled city, you're toast. Okay, so they have that protection in the hills. But they also had to contend with a difficult climate. They had to contend with precarious rainfall. This is something we're more familiar with here in Colorado, because our climate is somewhat similar to that. They had to deal with drought. The soil is extremely rocky. And while it is fertile, it is very difficult to work with. Farmers in North America complain about growing rocks. They don't have a clue what it's like to growing rocks the way that it is in the Mediterranean world, whether you're in Italy or Greece or Spain or whatever. It's just rocks everywhere. And so you're constantly fighting with your cultivation requires a great deal of effort to be productive. Now, the hills and the valleys created problems for distribution and for transportation. So your life is relatively confined to a relatively small area, because how are you going to get from place to place? Generally, you don't have wheeled vehicles. Okay, the Israelites at this time did not have chariots. That's another reason why they cannot survive on the plains. Okay, they have very little to do with carts and wheeled vehicles for transportation. So it's largely by beasts or by foot that you're getting around. So it's a relatively small region. So in this geographic area, and being a relatively small population, the clan and the tribal affiliations of the small villages provided for a relatively efficient social order and certainly a relatively egalitarian social order. Okay, when you're few, it's easier to be less regimented than when you are many. All right? Now, eventually, this social balance is going to be disturbed by a range of factors. And that time period when things were more egalitarian, when things were more equal, when things were better, is sort of the ideal period that we find in the imagination of the prophets. Oftentimes in the judgments that are going to be visited upon Israel that are described in Isaiah and Ezekiel and other places, they have to do with the destruction of the current social order and a restoration of a more agricultural economy. Okay, an or agricultural order that is necessarily more egalitarian. But a couple of things are going to we see developing over the course of the centuries after the initial settlement is an increase in population and an increase of food production to sustain that population, an expansion down into the area of the plains, and we see this especially in the time period of David and Solomon, where the Israelites are able to conquer. It's not until David and Solomon that they're actually able to conquer anywhere outside of the modern-day West Bank and hold it for any sustained period of time. Okay, so that's going to dramatically change things. And related to this is we're going to see the growth of cities. Now, we're not talking about cities the size of Fort Collins. I mean, this would be a massive city in that time period. But what we're talking about are cities where people do not have to be engaged in agriculture to sustain life. Okay, there is enough wealth production and food production and economic activity to sustain people who are engaged in crafts, people who are engaged in administration, people who are engaged in warfare, people who are engaged in religious the religious cult practices of the temple and whatever. Okay. Now, this increasing prosperity created a need to defend against outside enemies, because if you're poor and you don't have much to take, there's no reason to invade you. But if you are producing things, then that is provocative, right? Because, oh, I want to go take that guy's stuff. And that is what this is one of the fundamental building blocks of any political system in the pre-modern period, which makes us uncomfortable in the modern West, but throughout most of human history, you're not a good ruler unless you are beating up your neighbor and taking his stuff. I mean, that is part of your job, is to conquer your neighbor and take his stuff. That's what the Assyrians do. That's what David does, right? That's what Joshua and the judges are commanded to do. That's what Saul failed to do. That's why he lost his kingdom. Okay, so this is the norm. So again, we are, as I tell my students, we are one of the most bizarre societies in all of human history. And I'm glad I live in it because I fit perfectly here. But we have to recognize that we are quite different, and our expectations of normal are different than in pre-modern societies. All right. So now what we're going to need is a new means to order society, and this is what we're going to see with the establishment of the monarchy. Okay. It's not just that the ancient Israelites in the story of Samuel have become evil and want to have a king. Their social circumstances have changed sufficiently that they view that they need to have a new administrative model, and the model of monarchy is the one that the neighbors have, and it seems to be working. Okay, so there are rational choices being made here. They are condemned as morally imperfect choices in the book of Samuel, but they are rational choices from the point of view of what would we do in a similar situation? Probably exactly the same thing. Okay, this is one of the things that we always do need to, I think we need to remember when we read these the stories in the Bible that where people keep messing up. If we were in the same situation, we probably would do the exact same wrong things, because that tends to be how we behave, which I find to be incredibly hopeful, because these people, in time, they are held up as heroes. Okay, I mean, you read the book of Hebrews, and it talks about so-and-so had faith, and so-and-so had faith, and so-and-so had faith. Yes, they did, but if you read the whole story about each of those characters, they are lousy, corrupt, horrible people. But in the end, they are the ones that are held up as models. So if God can work them through them, there's hope for me. So I take that as an extremely hopeful thing. Now, I don't think that means that we're supposed to go and seek to emulate their negative sides. Okay, that's not what I'm advocating. But there is redemption. Okay, that is a constant message that we can never hear enough. All right, now in addition to the expansion of commerce and agricultural productivity, you know, we end up having to have people who are going to be the exchangers of those goods, merchants, right? And when we get to David's period, but especially Solomon's period, we're going to have massive building projects, and this requires labor. And you cannot have a massive building public works project unless you have enough peace and stability and economic wealth to put people to work on something other than producing food to sustain life. Okay, so we have a significant change in the social order. Now, we do not have a construction union here. Okay, most of the labor is forced labor, okay, and conscript labor. And we see this in the book of Kings, that the tribes in the regions along the northern frontier of Israel with what's nowadays modern Lebanon, they're not fond of Solomon because they're the ones who get shipped down to do the building. Okay, so they get to do the hard labor, and it's not exactly slavery, but it's certainly you don't get to just kind of say, well, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to take this job and shove it and go home. No, you don't have that option. Okay? So that's how that is. So it's not surprising that the more egalitarian, village-based society of the earlier period is going to become fractured, and it's going to change. With the death of Solomon and the divided monarchy, the nation is divided into Israel in the north, Judah in the south. We went over this last week. And the two entities, Israel and Judah, are frequently at odds with one another. Israel is wealthier. Israel is better. It's more successful. It is located closer to the international trade routes between Syria and northern modern-day Iraq and Egypt, and it's going to benefit more from that. During the 9th century, we're going to see significant pressures being exerted on the north from Syria by the Arameans. We're going to have a series of Aramean-Israelite wars that last for almost a century. The cities are going to be devastated. Population is going to be impoverished. Many of them are going to be refugees and moving down to the south. And towards the end of the century, when they have the Assyrians coming in, this is going to ease the situation on the Israelites in the north, because the Syrians are taking out their expansionary urges on northern Syria. But that will change in time, and they'll move south, okay? Because the Assyrians are very good at what they did. So the first half of the 8th century, we see a period of decline for Assyria, which is going to provide a break in the action for both Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And they're going to enjoy a fair amount of autonomy. And both kingdoms had benefited from the developments over the previous centuries, and they had benefited from being able to participate, at least some sectors of their society being able to participate in international trade in the area. And this is going to produce wealth for some. But it is a wealth that is confined to sort of the merchant classes and the urban classes, or certain classes within the cities. It is not a wealth and a bounty that is being participated in by the majority of the population. And so this is where we get that tension and the condemnation of the rich hoarding it and building beautiful homes for themselves while the temple of God is falling into disrepair. Or while the widow, the orphan, and the stranger is being neglected while you are living in your paneled homes. Okay, so you get that kind of rhetoric. And this is the situation that is going to give rise to the prophetic movement in the middle of the 8th century, where you get Amos and Hosea and Isaiah and Micah. All are condemning this economic situation. They're not condemning the economic situation. They're condemning the selfishness that those who have become wealthy, the way that they are treating those who are to be taken care of, and the way that they are ignoring God's house. So it's not so much that they have become wealthy, it's that they are not behaving properly with their wealth. All right? So verses 2 and 4 reflect this state of affairs, especially that the orphan, the lowly, the poor, the wretched, and the needy could not obtain justice. We talked about this last time when we talked about how courts are corrupted and people take bribes and people can be bought off, and that the widow, the orphan, the needy, the wretched are left out. So according to the psalmist, God has decided to convene the celestial council because the massive injustice that is in the land. And the question is, who is responsible for this injustice? Okay, who is to remedy this injustice? Is it human judges, or is it members of the divine assembly mentioned in verse 1? And you can read it both ways. And obviously you can read it as both ways, because there are plenty of other accounts throughout the Hebrew Bible where human judges are taking bribes, where human judges are corrupting justice. But it's conceivable that this psalm is describing more than just the fact that there are human judges who are corrupt, but that it may be speaking to the members of the divine assembly as well. And I'm going to try to explain why that is a plausible interpretation, that the hearers of this psalm would probably be thinking in two tracks at the same time, because they know that the judge that they went to see screwed them over. Okay, they know that. But they also are aware that the divine assembly is not doing its job either. Okay, so they're probably hearing this and thinking of it in both ways. To understand the second interpretation, we need to bear in mind that in the ancient world, it was widely believed that each people, even each city-state, had a divine protector. I mean, the divine protector of Israel, of course, is Yahweh. I mean, he is the personal God of the people of Israel. And the other peoples of the ancient Near East, whether they're in the city of Babylon or Nineveh or in Rosh Shamra up in the north, they each have their own local deity, their patron deity of that area. And that's his job. I looked at the hills whence cometh my help. My help cometh from Yahweh. Well, the ancient Israelites tended to win their wars in the hills. They were lousy in the valleys because they didn't have chariots. But the armies of Yahweh are successful in the hills, because God is, Yahweh is the God of this region. This is how it is understood. Now, this polytheistic conviction that each area has its own God is entirely unacceptable to the ancient Israelites for reasons that we've talked about repeatedly. And it's entirely rejected. But it is, if I'm going to say it's transformed into something, then it's not entirely rejected. But it's the idea that there are equal deities to Yahweh is utterly rejected. But it's transformed into this notion that each people had a supernatural or an angelic patron, okay, or a guardian angel that is allotted to it by God. And this is a concept that we we are aware of. We don't quite know what to do with it, and sometimes we get a little uncomfortable with the idea that there would be a guardian angel. Or especially when I had my car wreck, I thought, well, my guardian angel was doing his job in that I'm not dead, but he wasn't doing his job well enough because the accident happened. You know? And then you think, well, should I even be thinking those things? Maybe he'll not be so nice the next time. But we certainly get examples of this in the book of Deuteronomy and in some of the other passages. And I gave you these texts in the handouts. In Deuteronomy 4, we see this passage. When you look up to the sky and behold the sun and the moon and the stars, the whole heavenly host, you must not be lured into bowing down to them or serving them. These the Lord allotted to other peoples everywhere under heaven. Okay, these are the guardians of other folks. Yahweh is yours. Chapter 29 describes the same concept. They will be told, because they forsook the covenant that the Lord God of their fathers made with them when he freed them from the land of Egypt, they turned to the service of other gods and worshipped them. Gods whom they had not experienced and whom he had not allotted to them. So the question is, are they gods or are they divine beings? Okay. The problem is that we have this word Elohim, it's not always clear what it means in each time that it's used. We have this mysterious man that Jacob wrestled with. And he is described as a divine being. Okay, he is one of the Elohim, and some have posited that he may be the celestial patron of Edom, of Esau. You know, that is of the Edomites. Okay, here we have Jacob was left alone. A man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. Said he, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with divine beings." Okay, in some translations says because you have striven with God. Both are perfectly acceptable translations, but they depending on which word you choose there is going to change the meaning. But the problem for us is that it's not always clear what this word means. What does it mean in this context? But you have striven with beings divine or divine beings and human. That's what the text says, with beings divine and human. And have prevailed. So Jacob named the place Peniel, because I have seen a divine being face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Peniel meaning, Pani meaning face, and El meaning God. So I've seen the face of a divine being. All right. Now, this notion of a guardian angel is very explicit in the post-exilic period. And we see this very clearly in the book of Daniel, which is probably the last of all of the books of the Hebrew Bible that was composed. Okay, this is why it's not in the book of the prophets. In the Jewish division, it's in the writings, because it's not considered to be a prophetic book. Here in chapter 10. However, the prince of the Persian kingdom opposed me for 21 days. Now Michael, a prince of the first rank. Later on we have the prince of Persia, we have Prince Michael. So we have these celestial princes that are described in Daniel's visions in the book of Daniel. So they even have names by the time we get to this point. So the idea that I'm trying to assert here is that behind the text of Psalm 82 may be the idea that the guardian angels of the nations, who are expected to be responsible for overseeing justice, have failed in their charge and have abused their assigned function. This is a possible interpretation of this text. And I would assert that this is an interpretation of this text that the ancient Israelites would be very much aware of and would be... it's not entirely clear what the psalmist means when he writes this, but when this psalm is recited and at various times in the life of ancient Israel after it has been composed and it has been brought into the canon, the hearers of this psalm are going to be hearing it on both of these levels. That we can know for sure, okay? Because it is descriptive of the world that the ancient Israelites are quite familiar with. Yeah, Glenn.
This isn't foreign to us, right? We wrestle with principalities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We absolutely wrestle with those. But I don't need to. Maybe I'm being too apologetic and not wanting to be accused of misinterpreting the psalm or something here. Because I get one of the things that when we look at the psalms, they're generally looked at as models for how do we pray and how do they guide us in our devotional life. And if you look at the text that Jeff put together for us to read at the end of the service this week, it's just, okay, we'll take this verse from this psalm and this verse from this psalm, from this psalm, from this psalm. I mean, it's so easy for us to do that, and that is extremely important in learning how to pray properly. But there are, I guess I'm trying to point out that there's more to it than our own devotion in trying to understand these psalms in a more complete sense. But yeah, I absolutely agree with that. But this idea that the guardian angels of the nations, who are expected to be responsible for overseeing justice, they've failed. God's moral law has been violated. Conditions have deteriorated to such a point that God has to intervene. And whoever is responsible for the injustice, whether it's a human judge or a divine judge or a supernatural judge, it's clear from verse 5 that the speaker in the psalm, whether the speaker is God or human, has despaired of the ability of the judicial authorities, whether they're celestial judges or human judges, to reform themselves and remedy this intolerable state of affairs. Things have gotten so bad that if it's the divine assembly guys, they're hopeless. If it's human judges, they're hopeless. So we can look at it in both ways. What does he say in verse 5? They neither know nor understand. They go about in darkness, and the foundations of the earth totter. This is a rather severe condemnation of the incompetence and the corruption of the judges. If you're responsible for justice, you are enveloped in moral darkness. You cannot even see. You are so corrupt. You can't see straight. So the corruption that the responsible parties have caused undermines the very foundations of civilization. The world order has been disturbed, and they must be removed. So what does the psalmist tell us next? I have taken you for divine beings, sons of the Most High, all of you, but you shall die as men do, fall like any prince. So clearly he's speaking to the divine beings in some way. If we look at the sort of the divine counsel interpretation as the primary mode here, the psalm is speaking to these divine beings that have gone beyond the pale. If we are taking it that they are human judges, you could say that the humans who are responsible for justice are being addressed with sarcasm. You know, I have taken you as divine beings, as sons of the Most High, but you're worthless. You're nothing. Okay, you're corrupt. They're haughty, they're full of themselves, and they're accountable to no one, and God is going to intervene. If they're the guardian angels of the nations, then verses 6 and 7 evoke the myth about fallen angels, which is certainly in existence in ancient Israel and shows up periodically throughout the Hebrew Bible. We see it in Genesis 6, the section that I mentioned at the very beginning of today, where you have these divine beings who cohabit and have children with human women. And this is not good. Okay, this is, creates a problematic situation. Isaiah refers to, quote, the shining one, son of dawn, who was felled to earth. We see this elsewhere in Isaiah chapter 24, says that the Lord will punish the host of heaven in heaven and all the kings and the kings of the earth on earth. Job states that God, quote, cannot trust his own servants and cast reproach on his angels. Later, Job says that God puts no trust in his holy ones. The heavens are not guiltless in his sight. In all of these passages, most likely are referring to some now lost myth or story about a rebellious supernatural beings who forfeited their angelic status and are cast down from heaven. the son of the shining one, son of the dawn. This is sort of a passage, a story that is used to describe how Satan is cast out of heaven. Okay. Now the text itself refers to a specific earthly king, but it is interpreted to describe that. What's interesting is that story of the fallen angel, and this is how where you know Satan is cast out of heaven, and there are fallen angels and whatever. This is a story that is in quite detail in the Quran, which is a religious text that is based largely on the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. So many of these stories that are alluded to or touched on briefly in the Hebrew Bible that or the New Testament that are sort of fleshed out in the subsequent centuries after the text is put together in its final form are clearly in circulation in the 600s, and they're going to make it into another sacred text that is put together in the 600s with much more detail. That's just one of those fun facts that you can use to impress your friends at potlucks. I couldn't help but toss that in since that's what I also teach that stuff. Okay. So anyway, the divine beings in Psalm 82 would appear to be those who fell short of the divine standard and as a result were destined to die like mortals, to fall like the angelic princes of old who were expelled from heaven. They have gone so far. And after the violators are convicted, sentenced, the vision that we see here of God and his assembly is over. So we have this stark, unresolved reality of unwanted justice that abounds on earth. This is going to sort of overtake the consciousness of the psalmist. And things are so bad, what can the psalmist do? Okay, he's articulated how bad things have become. He has no other recourse but to take his case directly to God. And that is what he does in the last verse. And we have this rather urgent closing appeal. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for all the nations are your possession. Or as I use the translation at the top of the handout today, rise up, O God, judge the earth, for all the nations belong to you. And because of who he is, because of his sovereignty over all the nations, over all of creation, God alone is the one who possesses the power to execute judgment on earth. And this is something that is, I'm tossing this in just for another one of those fun facts. The twin themes of the Jewish New Year, which is celebrated in the fall of our calendar, this is a festival that is developed after the biblical period. Okay, this is not a biblical holiday. But the twin themes of the Jewish New Year observances are divine sovereignty and divine judgment. Okay, the twin themes of this psalm here. We do not know if such commemorations existed during biblical times. We don't know. We can't say yes, we can't say no. But if they did, then it is possible that one of the reasons that Psalm 82 was preserved in the book of Psalms by the community was because it belonged to the liturgy of such a day. This is merely speculation, but it's an intriguing one. But if you look at what's in this psalm, it's really only that last verse that is really psalmish. Okay, I mean, the other part is clearly poetry, but it's only that last verse where you're calling upon God to intervene and to redeem and to deliver that is sort of reminiscent of many of the other themes that we find in the whole book of Psalms. So this is a very this psalm itself kind of does stand out considerably. One last thing I want to do for those of you who haven't been to the service yet, at least in the worship band for today, we sang this old hymn, "Be Thou My Vision." And as I said last week, I can't sing the old hymns very. I choke up halfway through them. So I didn't make it through this one either. But I told you on the first day of class that the Psalms fit with everything. You can always find the Psalms in everything that we do. And you find this particular psalm in this particular hymn. When you look at the very last line of the third verse, High King of Heaven, my treasure thou art. And then the last stanza, High King of Heaven, my victory won, may I reach heaven's joy, O bright heaven's sun. Heart of my own heart, whatever befall, still be my vision, O ruler of all. And I just thought that was ironic that today we are doing a psalm that is a visionary psalm. I mean, it is a vision. Okay, he has this vision of the divine counsel. Okay, and who is the hymn writer calling upon to be his vision, but the exact same High King of Heaven and ruler of all. Okay, well. You can ask questions now. It's quitting time, so if you want to leave, you know, I won't be offended, but this is not a divine assembly. You can leave whenever you want. Go ahead.
This injustice toward the poor, is it because it exists, or is it because we take bribes and we're greedy, or what's the essence of this injustice?
In the Psalms? What do they mean by it? Well, I think in the context of, you know, books like Isaiah and this psalm and the other psalms that we've looked at, I think it's, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, that there the immediacy of injustice on the lives of those who have no protection in society is so dramatic. That I mean, because there is no social, there is no state in ancient Israel until we get to the monarchy, and then even then the state is weak, tremendously weak. So there is no mechanism for providing for those or for those who are in need to find redress. Okay, there is no mechanism for them to. Just to have sustenance, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, and were you here when you talked about that psalm? And I think that is, in certain sense, it's much more immediate in the minds of the hearers of the prophets like Isaiah and Micah and Hosea and those guys than it is for us, because for us, we don't have that level of potential destitution. As broadly dispersed in our society. We did in the 19th century. We did. I mean, when you look at the book that I referred to at the outset, that world was much more similar to the world that the Bible is describing. So when people read these psalms in 19th century America or early 20th century America or Depression era America, before the social networks begin to be created, I think it resonated in ways than it doesn't now. What are the implications of this for us today? I think it's very difficult because those who are without protection are not. They have protections if they seek to find them, because we live in the modern Western welfare state. Okay, this is the model of our society nowadays, which is a new model. I don't think that absolves us from meeting the need of those who have a need that needs to be met. But I think that the immediacy of that need is less than it used to be because of changes in medicine. I mean, in the 19th century, we didn't have vaccinations. You know what I mean? So you're dying. You know, child mortality is huge. Diseases, epidemics are rampant. In the 40s, 1840s and 50s, you'd have an outbreak in yellow fever in New Orleans, which is the third largest city in the United States, and you'd lose 20 to 30% of the population. Okay, we don't have those kinds of things nowadays. We have a horrendous natural disaster in California, and it's fewer than 50 from what I've heard, much fewer than 50 people have lost their lives. So there's been massive destruction of property, but there has not been loss of life and that kind of thing. So the scale that we deal with is, it's horrible for every individual, but the scale is so much smaller that I think it makes it easier for us to, somebody else will take care of it. And I know I do that. And also, I'm very cynical about the charity racket, and I don't mind calling it the charity racket, because we are a society that knows these psalms, and we are, I think that we are susceptible to this rhetoric. I want to know where that's going, because I want to know that the need is that someone I'm giving to meet a need, not to line the pockets of somebody in the charity racket. And how do you know that? How do you discern that? That's a difficult thing to do sometimes. Did I answer your question, Glenn? This is one of my problems. I am a teacher, so you give me a question, I'll go off forever and completely miss the point of the question. So I know that that happens. So if I didn't answer your question, ask it again.
Can I give you your answer?
Can you give me my answer? Yes, in your language, yes.
You're saying in the Western world, if they're poor and needy, all they have to do is ask. And that's different than the rest of the world where there really is poor and needy and injustice. Because we do have vaccines, we do have churches filled with food for those who are hungry. If they could just ask for help, they would normally get it here in the United States. Right?
Yeah, here in the United States, there you have to work to be destitute. And you have to there have to make some choices. And my brother used to work in. For 15 years, he worked with addicts and homeless and that kind of thing. And one of the things that he used to say frequently is that you end up at the mission because you have no bridges left to burn. Okay, you end up at the rescue mission because you have no bridges left to burn. That means that there. Now, it may be because you burned all the bridges, and it may be all because of your choices. But there are, you have to, you're not going to end up there unless you truly are destitute. And so there are places for that here. I think what the psalmist is talking about and what the prophets are talking about and what the Hebrew Bible is talking about is a society where everybody in the village knows who is in need because you see them. Because it's like if you live in a small town of, 500 people, here in the United States, you know who is in need. Or you know whose crops got burned. There was, lightning hit there and his crops got burned up and that family is in need. So the people of the neighborhood will take care of that. When we're in our big cities of millions of people, it's so much harder to recognize that. And the stuff is there, but people need to know that it's there, and still people need to be. How are they going to hear unless somebody tells them, and that kind of thing? But I think it's. I don't particularly like it when. Let me rephrase this. No matter where you fall on the political spectrum in our political system, you can find justification for your political views by reading the prophets. Or by reading the Bible. So you can be a complete far-out right-winger, or you can be a complete far-out left-winger, and you can find, you can do it, you can say, this is my political position, or this is my policy position, because I read the Bible, and the Bible tells me this is what I should do. Because it talks about everything, okay? So I'm always reluctant and very skeptical of people who will want to motivate me in what I think might be base political motives by quoting scripture. But I do think that there are certain things that go beyond that. And the language of the prophets do speak to the need to take care of those who do not have or who are in need or who are without. Now we debate about how we want our government to do that. And those are our political discussions. It does not absolve me as Jim from meeting a need that I see. So the political discussion is, what do I want the government to do for me? Or what is my obligation before God to do because God has commanded me to do that? So that, but if you're in India, for a more recent example, there is not that governmental safety net on the scope that it is here or in places in Western Europe and whatever. Yes, ma'am. Tell me your name.
Carol.
Thank you.
Different question. When you were talking about Jacob wrestling with a celestial being.
Yes.
I've oftentimes heard that was like the angel of the Lord, possibly Jesus himself.
Yes.
But it says, you know, that this celestial being and blessed Jacob. Would ancient Israel have believed that maybe an angel that wasn't God or Jesus, could an angel be given the power to bless him?
I think they would, yeah. That's why, the text says you've wrestled with beings, divine and human. I mean, it's ambiguous. So I said one possible interpretation is that since this is a story that's taking place in the north, and this is the literature from the north tends to be use the word Elohim more frequently than Yahweh. Maybe in the minds of the folks who are hearing this story up there, they're thinking of a patron deity of this region. Maybe they're thinking of an angel. Maybe they're thinking of, it's hard to think that it's God himself, you know, because why does God himself need to wrestle all night long with a deceitful, lying cheat named Jacob, which is my namesake. You know, if your name is any Jims in here, that's your real name, Jacob. So your biblical model is not great. But God used him in the end, so there is hope. I can tell you that particular vignette in the book of Genesis gallons and gallons and gallons of ink have been spilled trying to get out what does this actually mean, whether it's in the rabbinic tradition or the Christian tradition or the nerdy academic tradition that I fit in at this, for the purposes of my job. It can be read so many different, it's like the story of Abraham's sacrifice of Jacob, for crying out loud. That if that doesn't, you know, what is that story about? You know, there are so many of these stories that and a very, you know, simple, we have to teach these stories to our children so we come up with explanations that children can understand. But there are so many other levels that can be found in these that make it, it's hard to give this is the right answer to that question. Let's put it that way. A standard Christian, anytime you see these kinds of angels of God or supernatural beings, there's a tradition in Christian biblical interpretation that these are foreshadowings in some way, shape, or form of Jesus. Okay? Now, obviously, in the Jewish tradition, that's utterly rejected, because if you accept that interpretation, then you become a Christian. Okay, so that is a Christian interpretation. It's and I would find that difficult to think that the people of the ancient Israel would view it in those terms. And that's sort of a reading into the text interpretation.
The word Elohim being a plural Hebrew word, and us as Christians saying that supports the Trinity, and yet probably to a Jewish person it would just be celestial God and celestial beings.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't support that.
Yeah, and it doesn't, to a Jewish person it doesn't accept at all, no way, shape, or form. This is just like kings and queens always speak of themselves in the plural. You know, the royal we. And that would be how it would be understood. Either God speaking as the royal we, or depending on the context of the text, is talking about, you know, angelic beings of some sort. Yeah. Well, when it's
the wrong people or what?
No, when it's used as a compound noun with another word that has to do with strength, because you'll find a lot of times it's Yahweh. You know, God is judge, God is physician, God, you know, these things, and you'll find nouns that go that are put juxtaposed against Elohim. So, yeah, like El Elyon is God Most High. Okay, but it's two words. Okay, you're adding a noun, you're adding some sort of a descriptor, an adjective, to this to clarify which El you're talking about. Because this is just God with a small G in English. And you have, in English, when we're talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we use a capital G. So this word presents more problems for us for interpretation because it's a generic term, it's a generic Semitic term for God. When you find this word, there's no doubt whatsoever. We're talking about the God of Israel, the God who spoke to Moses. And... you know, unfortunately, they use this word too. So,
Jim, you know, we talk so much about taking, you know, portions of the Bible out of context. Couldn't we say that in Christian theology, whenever we take portions of the Old Testament and apply something that's not even inferred in the New Testament, that we're taking out of context?
Yeah, I think we can do that. I don't want to be dismissive of that because then I'm dismissive of the entire interpretive tradition of my own religion.
Okay.
But I think that...
on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I think that Christian scholars are less reluctant to do that, or they're more open to sort of a, what does this text mean in the context in which it was written? Or preserved. And then the other interpretive tradition is how has a tradition viewed this text? And those are two very different interpretive models. So I don't want to... I'm intrigued by how a tradition has interpreted text. My personality wants to know as best as I can what that text probably meant in the time period in which it is... Without attacking the other interpretation.
That's like studying Ecclesiastes, you know, who wrote it.
Yes.
You know, that's a biggie. And when you read it from a Jewish biblical point of view, well, even they had questions about it. But when the teacher talks about the problems of injustice, then the question is how could have Solomon written this, because he was in control. He could have changed the injustice system.
Right. Right.
So how can he speak in a third term when he was supposed to be in the first?
Right. Right. And these things are, it does matter where when you would argue that this particular section of the Hebrew Bible was written in a particular time, because that tells us something. If we accept that it was written at this particular time with this in mind, then we interpret it in one way. If somebody else is going to argue, no, this was written 300 years earlier in a different context, it's going to have different ramifications. I recognize all that stuff, and I make my living with that stuff, so I mean, I enjoy it. I think for us at this stage of the game, what's most important is what are the implications of what's in the text for how do we behave. Because I sort of on your question last week about the eschatology, eschatology racket would be how I put it. I mean, you can get caught up in all so many of these other things and miss the point that you are to do what God wants you to do. And I think that's a dilemma that we all face as we pursue our study of sacred scriptures. We can get caught up in the study and never get out of the study room.
One other thing I've begun to realize personally, that simple faith is enough.
It can be.
Because you take certain, there are certain individuals that have simple faith, and if you would bring what we've discussed in this class and other things to them, it would affect their faith.
Yes, and that's why I'm very careful. And the last thing that I would ever want to do is to undermine anybody, because that's not the point.
Right.
The point is to help us to understand more fully. But yes, I mean, simple faith is enough, but you want to make sure that the simple faith is in the right thing.
Yes. But you can go so deep into it with certain people that
yes.
their faith would be affected.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the rabbis make, I mean, one of the examples is that you're really supposed to be a full-grown adult and a well-educated and well-matured person before you begin to study the Song of Songs, mm-hmm. because you can get sidetracked. There are certain scriptures that are require a degree of maturity. So I think that kind of stuff is valid. Thank you very much.
Okay.